in fact, it was very coincidental that I was in hospital, and she was in Toronto, and she left her body while I was in the hospital. We couldn't quite really meet up. I was there, and I just came back. It was supposed to be a 10-minute procedure, this 1 month stay in the hospital, but it ended up expanding, so I couldn't go back and be with her then when she left. But I saw that it's something that worked personally in my life, in my sort of occupation. I spend a lot of time in hospitals visiting sick people, especially visiting those who are terminally sick, counseling them. And very often, I can't say always, but very often, whatever someone's belief may have had and however they may have been materialistically very active, when one comes to realize that my body's going, I'm going to lose my family, I'm going to lose my house, I'm going to lose... But instinctively, they search for what is it that I'm not going to lose? What is it that I can hang on to? And at that time, I think the receptivity opens. People become much more receptive at that time. And then those things which they may have heard before, and especially many people, for instance, from the Indian community, Asian community, to them, the teachings of Bhagavad Gita are sort of very standard. But then it's really sort of clicks. And very often you see sort of a conversion. People become very peaceful. They start to understand, yes, actually I'm not going to die, because no one wants to die. They recognize, yes, I am eternal, and although this body or this dress is going to have to change, just like it's already changed during this life, so what does death mean? Well, it means another change. And of course, the type of dress that we get, that then also depends upon how we've lived in this life. And that's another theme, or that's another topic. So we should stop for questions, because I'll just conclude just 1 minute. So my personal experience has been, both with myself as well as others, aside from just trying to explain from a philosophical point of view, that education of the soul, of our own identity, and I'm not talking about religion, because I haven't mentioned any religion. And this is common to everything. The word soul is it's used in Christianity, it's used in Islam, it's used in whether there's full clarity about what it means, it's something else, but it's actually ultimately who we are. And knowing our spiritual identity really helps give full benefit and full value to the physical, psychological, emotional care that we can actually give others. It gives the real anchor or the bottom upon which everything I think would find full maturity. And something that I'm not a medical man, I'm not a doctor, but I do it. I do it in medical institutions, I do it in hospitals, I do it in hospices, I do it in people's homes. I have that opportunity to see how the spiritual knowledge that people have, and now I'm not talking about last minute contributions. I see those other types of individuals for whom this has been a cultivation through their life. They really approach sickness. They have instruments and knowledge by which to deal with reverses in life and ultimately even death in an extraordinary, balanced and indifferent way. A very, 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 I've had just recently, a few days ago, one of my acquaintances, godbrothers, we call him, died, left his body, had a brain tumor, he died in South Africa. And the last time I talked to him, when I was able to, he was someone who, well, he joined our Krishna consciousness movement about the same time, like 40 years ago, but he was born in a Vaishnava family. He was born in a Krishna conscious family. So for him, it was like that. And I was thinking, I asked him, so it seems like the doctors say that it's terminal. He says, yes, it's terminal. He says, so what do you think? He says, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to giving up this body. I'm looking forward to going to Krishna. I said, are you afraid? He says, no. He says, what about if you have any type of pain or seizures or discomfort? He says, well, if that's what I deserve, if that's what it requires for me to fully purify myself before I leave this body, then I haven't complained while I've been alive, so why should I be complaining in my last days? And then 3 or 4 days ago, he just sort of left his body. So better to actually give that training throughout life, because it really prepares one for everything. It prepares one for the good things in life as well as these things, bad things, inevitable things, old age, disease, death. But even if it's not there throughout the life, at least certainly at these times when people are in a distressed condition, they're very, very open actually to hearing. They become much more sensitive to that. Not only just because they need, but I think they become more qualified to understand those things because they appreciate just the temporary nature of this world, and they're really looking for something that will give them lasting value. I hope I didn't talk too much, and I know we're limited in time, but perhaps if you have any other comments or questions, you could focus on this topic. Anyway, thank you for your kind patience.
Are you enough for a first question?
Thank you for that. Sometimes religion, and I'm a Catholic, is sometimes seen as an inoculation against the struggles with life, the pain of life. Sometimes seen maybe as an escape, or as an inoculation. And that, I'm not sure how to explain it, but that, let's say for me as aspiring Christian or whatever, it doesn't inoculate me from doubt and pain and sadness, depression, whatever. But it should, authentically, it should help me engage at a deeper level. But there's always the risk that we see religion as, or spirituality as, in some way it will inoculate us. Does that make sense?
Right? Yes. Like
rather
the,
than engage.
Like the opiate.
Yes. So I have to engage maybe at a deeper level with love, but also with pain maybe, I don't know. Especially as I engage with people around me, at my own stuff, as well as the stuff. Mm-hmm. And that includes confusion and whatever. Being in darkness as well as light. So that makes...
Yes, briefly, and just two points. Religion is meant to give spiritual knowledge. Spiritual knowledge is no different in its own right than mechanistic knowledge. So why do we acquire knowledge of so many things in this world, education, because knowledge helps us deal with the world. It helps us deal with life. So similarly, spiritual knowledge is not meant, and religion is not meant to escape from the world. It's meant to deal with the world in a different perspective, not in the perspective which is just matter and material issues and cause and effect, but it's meant to deal with it in a more subtle, in a more higher way. But when we talk about, and this is the second point, but when we talk about the soul, we're not really talking about religion. And rather, we're trying to express that this is a spiritual science. And there's a difference between religion and spiritual science. It's like mathematics. Mathematics is there in biology, chemistry, physics, of course, mathematics, everything, any field of learning is there. It's a common denominator. Similarly, in religion, there are basic spiritual science that's common to all religions. And over and beyond religion, it also infiltrates into everyday life. So the fact that we're conscious is not dependent on any religion. An atheist has to come up with good ideas to argue about why he's not conscious and why he's not conscious about being an atheist. So we're all conscious. And where does that consciousness come from? And that consciousness has not been identified or proven to come from any combination of material elements. So consciousness is a irreducible thing, but it's a symptom of something which escapes either material definition or material experimentation, and it is in the realm of the conscious. Source of consciousness, we just use the word soul. So that you can teach to everybody. One doesn't have to be religious in order to understand that he's a non-changing conscious entity. And I think that's a real advantage. Not only it's an advantage that it can be taught to non-religious people, but it's also that anyone can speak to one of any other faith. Any person of one conviction can present it to someone else, because it's really the same language, it's the same content. So in to avoid those barriers and obstacles that come up when, as soon as we get into the realm of religion, the concept of soul and so spiritual science is a different type of realm. Of course, there's a lot to be said about that. But it can assist anybody, and it doesn't require necessarily faith in God. Obviously, that's a subsequent step. For if you take both the logic and the philosophy further, but in it itself is substantial and can be universally applied.
It's a really privilege to listen to you speak, and my job's in the NHS, and a lot of the time it's the time element. So we're now in a profession where it's about how many people you can see and how fast you can see them. And I think to connect with people's identity takes time. Yet we're always under pressure to see more people with less staff. And you talked about having material things like clothes, but actually we're in a society that wants to move faster than ever, where my children want to be consulted over their mobile phone rather than face-to-face. And it's how do we, in a way, make the time to find somebody's identity when we're under pressure constantly to be more efficient with our time. So we've got nurses here today that know, you know, if you don't see more than six patients a day, then you're doing a bad job. Not saying they're doing a bad job, but you need to see a minimum of six. Well, what if it takes you all day to see one person? And actually the impact of that could be huge, because of what you're trying to do for them as a person, in a holistic way, not just physically.
All right, let me address your question just solely in terms of the medical field, and let me respond as a patient. And as I mentioned, I've had very little experience with being sick, and up to now, I've had all the time I needed from my doctors. They give me a lot of time. But I learned this experience of falling into this production line medical system, which it's bruising. It hurts. You feel like a commodity rather than a person. And I see that the doctors are under phenomenal pressure to do things. I see good doctors and good people. And they're having to churn faster and faster, and you get churned faster and faster. And to the extent that I have to remind them, they came at them, no, we're not going to do that type of contrast, because that type of contrast is not good for you. No, it's all right. It won't have the same effect as the other contrast, which caused your kidney failure. I said, okay, you just hang on. I'm going on the internet and finding out. You come back tomorrow and we'll talk about it. And we came back and we'll talk about it. It's just, here it says, with those with weak kidney symptoms, all right, so we'll get another alternative. And they did have another alternative. I don't know. I mean, that's something that NHS has to deal with and the whole medical system. And it's not NHS, because I had my problems started in Hungary and it was the same. I came across a wonderful doctor, young doctor, who urologist. But, yeah, I was like in this kind of grinder, and he was trying to churn me out. But he was nice enough that I sat down and I said, listen, either you give me time and we work properly. I just psychologically, I don't work like this. I want to be treated like a person. And then he did, at least with me. I don't know about the others. And I guess if there were fewer sick people, then doctors, the same amount of doctors, would have more time for less patients. And the solution may not lie with just the NHS and with the medical system itself, but it lies actually with the greater problem of how people live and our lifestyle and the way we eat and our pursuits in life and the stress levels that people are under and the destructive habits that they have, all of these things. I had this experience just briefly. I was going back and forth regularly to the urology department, and I had to wait outside, and I was standing outside the window in the hallway, and I was on the second floor, and then I would see the patients going outside and smoking down at the bottom. And I was thinking, I don't smoke. I haven't touched a cigarette in 45 years. Smoking is detrimental. Now, why do these chaps get in there before me? They have this, and why is it that the government, of course, they're collecting, reaps a whole lot of tax on these cigarettes, but at the same time, they're losing all that tax in the medical system because they're having to take care of these people with all these horrible lung problems. And, of course, if people weren't smoking and weren't drinking, and if, of course, that would be my argument, if they were become vegetarians, how much would your problems decrease? What to speak of if other lifestyle or life habit? So it just seems like NHS has got a reactive. You can't have a proactive approach because the problem started way before you ever came in contact with those patients. It's actually the world that we're living in, and perhaps it would be more better in the educational system if our educational system was a little different, and once again, if it wasn't trying to churn out computer programmers, engineers, lawyers, doctors, but it was actually trying to churn out quality people, and the emphasis was more on who you are rather than on what you are. And that it's all right if you're not a great performer, and if it's all right if you're not an achiever, then maybe we'll have a less consumer-oriented society, but we may have healthier people. As I know, for instance, in India, heart disease was sort of non-existent 30, 40 years ago, or something like that. It has certainly become a problem.
Huge problem now.
Huge problem.
Mark, could I give an example from to help Tracy with her question? This is about 10 years ago, within a 10-minute consultation. Yeah. A 35-year-old lady came, and she'd been brought up in Glasgow. She'd had a very difficult life, abuse, all the bad things that could happen to an individual. And she started self-harming at the age of 18. So she'd been self-harming for 17 years. And she showed me, and I met her for the first time, she showed me her arm. She had hundreds of cuts. And she says, "I keep cutting myself." I said, "You're not cutting yourself." And that's all I said. And she just sat back. And then I explained to her what Maharaj has been explaining to us this evening, that the body is not the self. And deeper was the soul. And she sat back and she said, "No one has spoken to me like this ever before." And she actually stopped cutting on the spot. She was a patient for 5 years before she went back to Scotland. She never cut again. And that's in a 10-minute consultation. And that's about understanding who I really am. And the futility of just like maybe the body is a demonstration of that internal frustration.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I was thinking is around how we treat stroke patients. And from a physical perspective, we tend to go in and do things to them, before them, to their physical shell, if you like, rather than actually sitting with them and explaining what's going on and actually teaching them and their families how to manage this situation. So we actually cause more work for ourselves as nurses, if you like, because we continually want to do things. So it's quite interesting listening to you about what we can take back and learn and apply.
Any more questions? Brad?
So basically, you have been raised to be part of the capitalist system where everything is money, and that's what we aim for. So that's the way we have been raised as well. So it's part of education or universities or colleges. So when we learn from the spiritual books that what we are, so how do we again go back to the same society that has taught us to be something else and align into some sort of a positive sort of a person who is spiritually inclined as well as part of the society that wants you to be sort of a materialistic person, if that makes sense?
Obviously one has to then set priorities, and being aware of one's spiritual identity, acting in a ethical, moral way doesn't mean that you have to retire from society. That's one of the advantages of being in a democracy, is that everyone isn't forced to do things. We can have a choice as to how we live. And we can have a choice as to where we want to be in the treadmill. We don't have to really go that fast. We can step out and we can set that actually our priorities are for our own welfare, that we spend time with our families, that we spend time in recreation and so on, and we rearrange our lives in a different way. And this is something that I very, very often talk to, especially with our youth, that don't start with what it is that you want to achieve and work backward and see how much time you've got left for yourself, your family, and the things that really matter in life, knowing yourself better, but rather start the other way. How much time do you need? And then see the time that's left, what it is, time that you have left for that, and then within that, accept that's your sort of quota, that's your karma. Some people in that time frame may be able to become millionaires, and other people will just get by. That's all right. Just get by, as long as both the millionaire and the people who are getting by are really happy. because ultimately this is the quest of the soul. But because we're looking for happiness in the body, therefore it's a never-ending catch-22 situation that no one is really happy and no one is really satisfied. So it's that type of priority, and therefore one can continue, whether being an engineer, a lawyer, a doctor, and so on. But I don't work myself to death in order to compete with my neighbors. But rather, I keep a certain pace in life, and this is as much as I'm willing to do, because I also have other things that I need to do for life. So how many people are so busy working, they neglect their families. As a result of that, they divorce, their children become resentful, everything becomes topsy-turvy, and this is just a sociological phenomenon that's taking place more and more. So it doesn't require retiring, it's just how do we actually fit in a way that we don't compromise our own personal needs, and it's possible.
I just a comment really rather than question. The way we, my generation, I have teenagers, so the way we treat our teenagers, one of the questions that every adult seems to ask the teenagers, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the answer we expect is, oh, a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant, whatever it is. But one teenager said to me, I want to be well and I want to be happy. And it was such a refreshing change, just spinning it round and saying, so how do I teach my teenagers to be well and happy? And it's a different priority to what our society expects teenagers to be. It's just a different way of thinking.
Yeah. And then what does wellness and happiness really mean? Mm-hmm. It will start, well, know who you are.
Back to our bird.
Yeah. Know who you are. Start with the beginning. Start at the very beginning. And don't let yourself get pressured into having to identify happiness with achievement, because the achievers aren't happy. They're...
On the basis that most adults are not very spiritually aware, how do we encourage them and ourselves to make our children, to help our children initiate that self-study?
It requires education. It's also just like with everything that we want to pass on to our children, any knowledge, we need to have the education, and then we can also pass it on to them. So in the same way, the knowledge of the self is something that we should learn about, and then we can give it to others. And once again, because it's not something that necessarily identifies with one religion or one faith or another, but it's science, and it's science not just in the sense that I'm using the word, but it's a science because science, what is a scientific process means? That there's observation, that there's a hypothesis, you have observation, you have an experiment. So similarly, the science of the soul, if you investigate and use your intelligence, you will be able to see, you will be able to understand the spiritual presence of the soul, but it also requires, again, experimentation. What's the experiment? Now, in traditional in India and traditional Indian system, it's yoga. That is what yoga means. Yoga means to connect, and the practices of yoga are meant to connect with yourself. So you know what I'm talking about. And then there are different yoga systems, and they're all meant to do that.
Yes, I understand that element is for those people who aren't yoga teachers, and I don't consider that I know my spiritual identity entirely. At the age of 40, 50, whatever, to generate that level of knowledge. You know, the child's grown up, by the time you've got hold of it yourself, it's too late to pass it on. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's not too late to pass it on, because it's never too late to start, but the child is already grown?
Well, if you start at the very beginning, like children go to school at the age of 6, or even previous to that, they're already going to nursery. So this is also a very in-depth science. We can see that although you've got a lot of wise men who can figure out, though they haven't quite figured out what the atom and the electron is about yet, but so many things that we figured out about this world and the laws that govern this world, but the laws that govern the self, we haven't really gotten very far. Of course, the channels that we've tried to approach haven't necessarily been correct. But there's a lot there to learn. And children need to be taught at an early age, because that's when they're most receptive. And they'll understand before they become corrupt by other types of thinking. At least they should be given the opportunity to think like this, rather than we may consider that actually our whole material approach to life is a type of brainwashing, because we're giving just one perspective of reality and sort of denying this other perspective. By we, I'm just generalizing that sort of that's what the world around us is more or less doing. Oh, that's religion, and that's just for something else, and it's not, you know, we're a secular society, we have nothing to do with the soul. But why? Who said? And why have we become so selective? And why have we, is there something endangering people's lives? So yes, they have a right to know, and they should. So there are texts. That's why, for instance, we use Bhagavad Gita, which is teaching the science of the soul. And what are the laws that affect the soul? How is it our environment actually affects our way of thinking and acting and behavior? How to control the influences of the environment? How to become actually free or transcendental to the effects of the environment? And for all intents and purposes, it's got nothing really to do with religion. This is still just knowing how the soul functions in this world, rather than just knowing how the world is moving and how our body is moving within this world. So there's a lot to know, and they should be taught, and it's parents' duty.
How would you say mindfulness fits in with the science of the soul? Because mindfulness is something that we're becoming increasingly aware of, and I just wonder how that sits with you.
When I was sitting in Dr. Patel or Oliver, both, in her office, I saw the brochure on mindfulness.
That's
right, we were talking about it earlier. Really, what does it mean, giving people time to sit down and think a little and help their thinking so that they can consider things in different light? And I think that that's a very positive and engaging way of helping others, whether it be to deal with stress or to overcome difficulty and adversities. I was just suggesting earlier to Mike that, but underneath that, whose mind? We're talking about mindfulness, but whose mind is it? It's my mind. It's the mind of the soul. And to have that underlying knowledge, that adds a different dimension to mindfulness, which is really a form of meditation. Just using different terminology, but it means to meditate and to learn certain ways of directing our minds, our attitudes, and by that seeing things in a different way. But when our real identity, spiritual identity, is the foundation or the bedrock of that, then it becomes, it would become even more fuller or complete.
When we talk about as finding our own identity, I mean, in a society where there's so much pressure on trying to fit in with people, what would you recommend to do that? What's the process that you go through? Because, I mean, I'm the first to admit that I'm a different person depending on who I'm with, because I've not obviously found that element in my life. How would you recommend to do that?
Well, this is, I wasn't striving to fit in. That's why I'm dressed like this and chose this path. But we really need to be true to ourselves. We need to be clear on who we are, and not only who we are as spiritual identity, but actually what is our business here in this world? And of course, that's a whole different subject matter. But what is the mission of the human being? Is it just to die? And in that meantime, we just eat, sleep, and drink, and be merry. That's called hedonism. So is that what really civilization is about, that we've turned into a hedonistic society? Or are we very, very clear that society has, and individuals have, a higher goal, a higher purpose to achieve? And our purpose starts with knowing ourselves and actually perfecting our identities. We had in Hungary, we had an Indian ambassador. We just got a new one, but he was very very nice gentleman, very nice man. We had a very nice exchange with him, and we have a theological college there as well, part of the Krishna consciousness movement. It's an accredited college, and he would come and give lectures. Anyway, he would like to give lectures everywhere, so we invited him at public programs and so on. And one of his favorite lectures was GDP. And he said, our modern society equates civilization success with GDP. And what does GDP depend upon? How much money is being spent. So I mean, I'll just make sure. But he used to say, all right, so in this society, in a society where you have prostitution and people spend money on prostitutes, you mean to tell me that that's a more civilized society than one where they don't? By GDP, it is, because it's generating more income. Or a country that's producing arms and making tons and tons of money by selling arms to some other country to cause all kinds of havoc, that's more civil. So it's like that. This is what our measure has been. This is how we measure success. And by what we're achieving rather than by who we are. And then being very, very fixed in who we are, independent of what others think of us, that we're not chameleons. We're meant to be willed, strong-willed persons who understand our own individuality. And once we understand our individuality, because we're our individuals, we'll find that we've got a lot to be proud of. We don't have to be like anybody else. We just have to be ourselves.
When we're born and our souls are right at the beginning, are all our souls essentially the same? Or are some souls already been through some kind of, I don't know, ancestors, wherever they've come from, disadvantage or advantage in this world that we live in? Or are we all exactly the same right at the beginning? Are all souls as fresh and as pure as I imagine they would be? Or have they already got some kind of history to them?
As Krishna says, as tathādehantara prāptiya, so just as the soul doesn't change in this life, so the soul doesn't change at the end of this life. In one sense, change of body means death. My baby body's died and it's become an adult body. So the soul is eternal. So your question is that when souls die, when souls take birth again in the world, they're, in one sense, identical, in that the nature of the soul is identical, but they all have different karmas. What did you do in your past life? Where were you in your past life? And so we come with different psychology, we come with a different set of karmic baggage, which means that it's going to unfold in different ways. Someone's going to take birth in Africa, Someone's going to take birth in New York. Someone's going to be the son of a millionaire. Someone's going to become very poor. Someone's going to be successful. Someone else, no matter how hard they work, they're just not going to make it. Someone's going to become a musician, a pianist, and someone else is going to be a mathematical genius. And it's not happening by chance. It's happening because of the previous activities that that soul is bringing over and continuing on. But the unique feature, and of course that soul is not only present in humans, but it's present in every living entity. It's present in animals and plants and so on. They have a different karma. But the unique feature of the human being, the humans can actually make their own destiny. You can change your fate. And that other species of life can't do. And why? Because we have a level of intelligence that others don't have. Unfortunately, we use our intelligence to make atom bombs and threaten each other. And we make so many other different things that we use our intelligence for. But we can use our intelligence to actually change our fate and to change the direction in which our past karma has actually directed us in. And that's really what it means. But then we have to know, where is it that I need to go in life? What is really the goal of life? What is the purpose of human beings? Are we over time?
We're on Indian time.
I'm always going to
play. That means it's just the introduction.
Yeah, if you're going to an Indian wedding and it's at 12:30, that's when you leave the house. That's not when you...
I've just got one question.
Yes.
My question is about food and diet, and I know you touched on people being vegetarian. We know that our bodies need a certain amount of nutrients and requirements from food. I like to think I eat quite soul food, but how important or how do you feel about sort of soulful eating and what does food do for our souls?
Soulful
eating.
Soulful
eating.
Yes, but can you clarify what that means, soulful eating?
Soulful eating.
You mean food for the soul?
Yeah, of course, food for the soul.
Well, the soul doesn't need to be fed, it doesn't need to drink. Our bodies need it. But soulful would mean that there are certain types of food that make it difficult for us to understand our spiritual nature and certain types of food that enhance our understanding. Alcohol clouds your intelligence. But other types of food also. So for instance, why is it that we don't eat meat? Because that, as Bernard Shaw said, you are what you eat. So meat is a byproduct of extreme violence. When one consumes violent things, then it affects one's consciousness, and therefore the ability to understand our spiritual nature and for the soul to actually manifest its full potential becomes impaired. So food is very relevant as to the type of life that we want to lead. Yeah.
How about eating dairy products? How does that, relate to the soul in terms of...
Dairy products are very desirable, but they shouldn't come from animals that are sent to slaughterhouses. So that's why, for instance, in Hungary, you have, and here also, we have, for us, we believe that cow protection, that's why in India you've heard of this word sacred cow, although it shouldn't be taken that the cow is sacred. The cow is sacred in the way that, for instance, a mother is sacred. But cows are protected animals because dairy and dairy products are so important and so conducive to soul food. Dairy is soul food. It's the, according to Bhagavad Gita and scriptures, the prime soul food.
I think wondered if we could make Sarah's the last formal question, and then if people want to stay up here and ask Maharaj any more questions, I'm sure they're welcome. I'm going to in a minute ask Sam if she's still okay for that. Give a vote of thanks. Is that okay? Yeah. I'm going to do that, dear. Reading the instructions. Thank you all very much for coming and for making the evening. It's a very big day for us that after... I get very emotional, as people know. Many years of putting this together to actually have Maharaj here today is really important. So, thank you all very much for coming and helping to make that. There is a vegetarian meal downstairs, or some snacks. Just as Mike is the chief executive of the Mental Health Trust, he said the biggest in the country. So, in this area of Nottingham, we have a healthcare commissioning team, and I'm fortunate to work as the clinical lead in that team, and I work with Sam, who's the responsible officer. So she's accountable for the provision and commission of healthcare.
I'm thinking there's someone else is responsible.
So, in the healthcare world, Mike's a provider and Sam's a commissioner. So I'd like to ask Sam to come and give a vote of thanks to Mike. Thank you for bringing Harry here.
My husband. I've been absolutely delighted and honoured to be sitting there, and I've actually got a bit of a tear at the back of my eyes because you've personally resonated for me, not only in what I do for a living from the health point of view, because I've long since felt that we're missing something as health professionals. The medical profession is brilliant, but we treat, we intervene, we use equipment, we use drugs. We're missing something. We treat what we see. What are we not seeing? And it's this consciousness bit. I'm also a trained physicist and mathematician, so when you were talking about Descartes, one of my heroes, and the experimentation and observation, you were ticking all my boxes that were going down, which made me extremely excited. But also, I feel that what you said resonated with me, and there's probably elements that's resonated with every single person in this room, because it feels like I've had a light bulb moment or a time bomb going off, and it feels like, from the bottom of my heart, that you've dragged my consciousness out from the dark.
Thank you very much.
I forgot to say anything. Would you like to say something?
A very big thank you to you for inspiring us and how mindful for my here. These two gentlemen have worked so hard. And to say that, as well as the wonderful snack that we have downstairs, and here's the lady who has been busily making it and bringing it here, including bringing it up all the stairs and serving. We also have some literature, if you have some time to browse, on the table here. And you are very, very welcome to Miss Peacock Health Cares anytime. You wish to, you know all know how to get hold of us. I'm really proud of Sally and Eve, who really, this was all a building site and they wanted to choose these colours, and they call this a heart space, and they're very hard to practice, and you're very welcome. Kind of send it
enough. Enough said.
Thank you
all very much.
Thank you.
I really felt for the mothers who are asking questions about their teenagers, and this strangled me myself bringing children up, and I'm so proud to introduce you to Sage that Gopala's son has come today, and just yesterday he passed his MRCP part 2.
palliative care and to these 3-4 months, and he's come with his wife Rebecca and our she might be very cross with me afterwards. Oh, now she can't be, because that's been, and next to Rebecca is our next daughter-in-law to be, Lucy, Lucy Callaghan, and her mum Kim. So it's a big family affair. It's great fun to actually train along, learning about the soul. I found it very scientific and very nourishing and very inspiring, all because of His Holiness giving us this knowledge, you know, drip-feeding us bit by bit and from bringing us to our senses.
From the Bhagavad Gita.
From the Bhagavad Gita, I would like me to say. So thank you.
Thank you.
So if you go on to the next floor down and turn left, that's where special day. Please have a seat. Come to the front. Okay, wherever she says, you can see my
dear, help us, right?
Sometimes wonder why I'm standing here, but anyway, the action's there, the lips move here. Housekeeping, there are no fire alarms. So that if you should hear one, then follow the green man down there, and assemble in the car park. A very big welcome, as I say, to this is the first Peacock lecture in our new building. And we've got His Holiness Shivaram Swami, and I'm not going to say a lot more, except to welcome my cook, CB, to introduce His Holiness.
I'm missing something. It's a very important tradition to which is here.
I'll do that. So I will ask Mike to put this on Shivaram Swami's. If that's alright.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
This is, of course, the customary welcome to a learned speaker, and
I'll help you.
You're going to help.
Oh.
Thank you, Paul Oliver, a great GP, and Hina Patel. Thank you for being GPs in Ottawa. We're lucky to have you. I know you started. 1980s, 1980, there were 10 when I went to medical school. But it's lovely to see you. Thank you for inviting us to this great practice. And Michael Orozco, who's hovering and sorting everybody out as ever, as a team, you've really done great things to build this. And I know you opened in April 2013, and many patients and the community are benefiting from the wisdom and skills of this practice. And one of the reasons why it is such a wise practice is because Hina and Paul are very into thinking about people very deeply, and one of the inspirations for them is His Holiness today, who I'm going to introduce in a second. And it's an absolute delight to have you in Nottingham today. I've had a pleasure of just 10 minutes together, and I feel calmer, I feel more thoughtful, I feel more mindful. And it's really through your teachings that I know Paul and Hina have been inspired to change the way they practice with patients and think very deeply about the traumas that are caused through medicine, through very difficult circumstances, the traumas of mental health, the traumas of physical health, cancers, accidents. How do you deal with the deeper underlying person behind that who's got to recover and come back from such difficult circumstances? And I know that a lot of the learning you've had from our guru today is going to be, and we're going to get a little sample of that in a minute, but on behalf of Peacock Healthcare, who are a wonderful practice, we're very proud to be associated with you, and all of our community. We're here to learn, and you are very, very welcome in Nottingham tonight, and we look forward to hearing you. You're going to talk to us about the importance of the understanding of the soul in maintaining the fullness of health. And as the biggest mental health provider in the country that I try and do, I know there's a huge relationship with the soul and with physical health too. So we're really delighted to have your wisdom here tonight. You're very welcome. Thank you for being with us, His Holiness.
Thank you very much. I guess just a disclaimer before I start. Whatever I will say is not really my wisdom and anything which I've managed to pass on over the years to doctors here who were also my GPs for quite some time is something which I've also heard from my spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who's the founder of the Krishna Consciousness Movement. And whatever I got from him, he didn't make up or discover on his own, but actually it's something that comes down in what's called a parampara, which is a Sanskrit word, but basically it's something that we all have experience with. It's the teaching process, the learning process. When I went to my spiritual master, I learned from him what he learned from his guru, and so on. That was the same when I went to school or university. Then I learned from my professor what he learned from his professor, what he learned from his professor. And this chain of teachers, or parampara, this actually dates back to 5,000 years. Unbroken. It's an unbroken chain. My professors didn't go back that far. But this spiritual lineage does. And all of these original teachings can be found in the Bhagavad Gita, which I think many of you may have heard of, if not read. This is like the Bible of the Hindus. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna is the speaker, and he speaks in 700 concise verses the essence of that which man needs to know in order to navigate through all the obstacles and difficulties that one encounters in life. And the first teaching that Krishna gives is the teaching of the soul. In other words, what is the soul? Originally, I'm from Hungary, and up until between 1980 and about 2005, I was based here in the UK. And I was traveling around to our centers, and I came here in Nottingham in 1981, first, I think. And then I moved my base, moved to Hungary, or at least I was moved to Hungary. Although I preferred to be here, but still, I was requested to go there. But I just make that reference. Interestingly, in Hungary, there's no clear word for this word soul. They use the word szellem or lélek, but it doesn't actually have the same connotation. It more means spirit rather than soul. And in Sanskrit, the word is atma. So Lord Krishna first explains in the Bhagavad Gita, he first talks about the soul. And there's a very important reason for that, because it's the first thing that everyone needs to know. Soul or atma really means our identity, who we are. And obviously, in any field of learning, and whether it's just education or even just raising children and developing in life, the first thing, one would think that the most important thing and the first thing to know is who I am. Now, either I went to the wrong educational institutions, But I never encountered that type of education where I was told who I am. I was certainly told what I should be, but I was never really told who I am. And I experienced myself that ended up causing quite a bit of confusion in my life until I met my spiritual master, because different people had different ideas about what I should be, but no one had, not any answers, because I didn't even have the question. It didn't occur to me that I should really know who I am. Until I started coming in contact with Bhagavad Gita, and I realized that this is the ABC. Everything's based on this. If we don't really know our real identity, then how can we go forward? We just have common phrase, I want this, I want to do that. But who's the I? How do I know what I want? How do I know what I want to do? How do I know anything unless I know who the I is? And so this, sometimes the word ego is also used. What is actually our real identity? And in Sanskrit language, Krishna begins to describe the indicators by which we can come to understand what that soul is. Because the soul is a word. Now you can use any word. I can use the word Atma or soul or Hungarian and Lelek. But what does it really refer to? What is the real identity of the living entity of all of us? And so he says, Komara Jovara Jara Tata Dehantara Praptir. He says, just take note that our bodies are always changing. We have Komara, means child, Jovana means youth, Jara means old age. Our bodies constantly change, and it's not just our gross bodies change, but of course our intellect changes, our way of thinking changes, but there's something that doesn't change. Hopefully something agree that we have, there's an identity, there's an essential we that doesn't change, that remembers, of course, everything that happens throughout the course of our lives, and has a I'm thinking in Hungarian, I'm not in practice speaking English, and has a sense of sameness. That's us. And of course, we know we're the same person as we were when we were in the cradle. And certainly our mothers know, you're never going to convince them that I'm a different person. They know that you're the same person. And the government knows. It's not that every month we need to get a new passport because our identity has changed. We're still the same person, even though the picture changes. And they may look and say, well, you've gotten a little older, but we're still the same person. So what is it that, despite the continuity, intellectual, mental, physical changes take place, but there's a continuity that's there? Because change means it's not the same. And whereas the continuity and the non-changing means that it's a constant. So that constant must be us. Otherwise, we'd really be in a real dilemma. We'd be with a real constant paranoia as to who we really are, because we're losing our bearings, we're losing our coordinates on a daily, momentary basis. Our bodies are changing constantly. So that which doesn't change, Krishna says, throughout all of these changes of our body, that is the soul. Now, the world that we live in is very much... if we go back a few hundred years, when science really gained great momentum and respect, and not only momentum and respect, but real results. society, people were observing, scientists were observing and studying the world around us and trying to find out what it is that made the world move, what were the laws governing this world, and obviously what were the laws that were also governing us. And there are two aspects, well, of course there's many aspects, but three general aspects to the scientific perspective. One is matter itself and the world, the gross world that we live in. And the other one is the person who's conscious of all of these things. In other words, we're conscious entities. And we're aware of phenomena. Phenomena take place. So science has been very good in explaining how phenomena take place. But great difficulty in actually identifying who is the observer that is actually seeing all of these phenomena. You know, the mathematician Descartes, at that time, it wasn't so much this soul from a scientific perspective, they tried to approach it mind and body. And when I talk about soul, it's a different thing than the mind. Mind is more of a subtle part of the body. The body we see as a holistic, in a holistic perspective, the body has these three aspects. It has the gross senses, and it has a brain, which is a mechanism that works the body based upon the programming of the mind. And the mind you can consider to be sort of like the software of the brain. And that software of the brain is also being managed by the discriminative faculty of the intelligence. But all of these things are sort of material energies or material things. And for the most part, science is successful in explaining what this body is. Medicine is all about how to repair the body, which Krishna calls yantra. So yantra means machine. It's a machine. So how to repair the body, whether we're repairing this gross body, or we know that when people's minds are impaired, then that also requires repair. We psychologically try to repair the mind. But all of these things are being observed. I can observe my intelligence working, I can observe my mind working, I can observe my body working, I can observe the world around me. Who is the observer? And scientists have not been very expert in actually trying to identify that. Well, yes, I was talking about Descartes. Descartes was a very expert mathematician. He's also a thinker. And he recognized, and we usually refer to this as dualism, Descartes' dualism. And he posited that there was a real difference between the body, which is matter, and mind, or the observer, or consciousness. And whereas the body was, especially after Newton's time, it started to become easier and easier to understand what are these laws of action and reaction, how are things working, and science really moved forward by leaps and bounds and got very significant results. But this other idea of trying to identify and quantify the observer, or that person who was actually conscious of everything was going on, got more or less nowhere. And Krishna explains why we get nowhere, and we're nowhere because we're using the same type of tools to study something which is of a completely different nature. It's a different substance. Consciousness is something which is ultimately inexplicable by mechanistic reductionist terms. requires a different type of approach. And yet it exists. We're conscious of each other. We're conscious that we exist. And it's that consciousness that ultimately is our identity. I don't want to diverge too far into that type of philosophy, because I like to bring it to the relevance of knowing and recognizing the existence of this soul for being healthy individuals, for making people healthy. And as I started at the very beginning, that without knowing who we are, without knowing who is the observer, who is that that's conscious of everything, who is that that feels pain and pleasure, there's a substratum that's completely missing in our lives. And when that substratum is absent, knowledge of our own identity, then no matter what else we do after that, something continues to remain missing. And therefore, not only is it that physically sick people or psychologically sick people are missing something in their lives, it means that everybody is missing something in their lives. And the most important thing that we're missing in their lives is really a full awareness of our true identity, of who we are. So my spiritual master would give this very simple example, like a mathematical calculation, maybe a five-step mathematical calculation. If the first one and one, and you make it three, everything else may be very correct afterwards, but the result is never really correct. In fact, the more calculations you do, the further off you get from the right answer. So isn't the most important thing and the most basic thing is for us to actually be clear about who we really are and recognize the fact that this body is a very useful instrument, a machine, but ultimately, anyway, you know as well or better than I do, that people can do without large parts of their body and continue on. They may be impaired in certain ways, but them as people, they don't change. So unless this basic calculation is there, we are more or less, Krishna uses this other example, Vasang Sujirnani Jatavihaya. He says the body is just like clothes. It's just like the dress that we're wearing. So, of course, clothes are compulsory in a civilized society. We're wearing clothes. But still, our clothes are very different from who we are. And if we become a society who simply pampers to the clothes, and in fact we are a society, a very fashion conscious society, and very fashion oriented, at least those who can afford it are fashion oriented, but if all we do is pamper to the clothes, then we're really neglecting the inner self. Another example that's given also in the Upanishads is if you picture that this body is like a cage, and inside this cage is a bird. And you polish the cage, and you polish it, and you polish it, and you polish it, but you neglect to feed the bird. And ultimately, you may have a very shiny cage, but you end up with a dead parrot. So, of course, the soul doesn't die. But still, when the soul is neglected, when the soul's needs are not really met, then ultimately, even though we may be physically or in some other way considered healthy, but actually we're not really happy. Neither are we whole or well-balanced. And so this spiritual happiness is something, and this nurturing, spiritual nurturing, is really what all religions are meant to be doing. They're meant to be actually catering and satisfying the needs of the soul and actually teaching us as laymen how to not just practice spiritual life once a week, or who knows, once a year, but actually on a daily basis, because that's the most important thing to us. That's the most integral thing to us. So in medicine and in just treating people, I had a good experience. Fortunately, up to the first 63 years of my life, of course they were almost the last 63 also, but the first 63 of my life, I never saw the inside of a hospital. Well, once I did here in Nottingham. But that was just for a very minor thing. But I had an operation in the beginning of last year. And as a result of that operation beginning of last year, which was a minor operation, a prostate operation, then there was some minor complication, and I came back in March to the hospital. This was down in London. And due to my reaction to medication and some other tests, I ended up being in the hospital for a week with almost kidney failure and a whole host of things. All of a sudden, it was like all of a sudden my body rebelled and it started to implode. So at least I had a good experience. Not a good experience. I had an experience of what it meant to be sick and what it meant to be treated. And I observed my own psychology, and I saw how important it was for me to recognize that I was in pain. It was more extreme discomfort, dizziness, and nausea, some pain, but that was actually quite minor compared to these other things. And of course the worst thing was being locked up in a room. Not locked up, I was confined to more or less a room for a whole month. And I saw what type of psychological effect this had, what type of physical effect it had on me. For a change, instead of advising other people, I had to start preaching to myself. And that was very useful. And I found that my ability to tolerate these conditions and to be able to deal with it was so much facilitated by the fact that I understood that this is actually not happening to my soul, because my soul isn't affected by these material things. This is actually happening to my body. And if I'm patient and if I tolerate, and of course then there's a whole other aspect to all of this, if I accept it, well, this is my fate. We were talking earlier about karma. And this is my karma. The things aren't happening by accident. And I should just tolerate this particular situation. But this spiritual identification, recognizing that my soul was completely free from all of these inconveniences, it really helped me center. But as a side result of that was my doctors were bringing in other patients, and they said, well, I have this patient, I'd like you to talk to him, he's quite distressed. And I said, why are you asking me to talk to him? I'm lying in the bed, why don't you talk to him? He says, no, you should talk to him. And then they talked to him, and I had 4 or 5 consultants, and I was being very nicely taken care of. And I ended up having to talk to them as well and explain to them. And I became quite well known in the ward because I was there more than anybody else. And it was something that I saw the other members of the staff, whether it be nurses or the doctors or the consultants that they and the other patients, that they very much appreciated. Just earlier I was mentioning that when I became a devotee almost 45 years ago, then my mother could never really accept it. My father was sort of a different person, and he, whatever was was good for me, it was good for him. But despite the fact that my mother and I never really saw eye to eye, every time that there was either a death in the family or some relatives, there was a death with some relatives or acquaintances or friends, she would always ask me to say, Peter, that's my other name, Peter. And she would say, Peter, can you write a letter to such and such? Can you write a letter to your aunt? Can you write a letter to this person? Explain to them about the soul. So why are you telling me to do this? She says, why don't you do this? I don't believe in it, but you tell them anyway. Because it makes them feel very peaceful. I said, why do you think it makes them feel very peaceful? He says, I don't know, but you write it anyway. Well, maybe it makes them feel peaceful because it has a ring of truth about it. Anyway, she didn't want to know. Even to the last day, she didn't want to know.